Time to take a look at climate and weather next with our weather guys. They come by once a month, the last Monday of the month, of every month, to talk about some weather event or fact or another. And today we'll start by talking maybe about where they work and what they do. Larry Mueller here again, and thanks for joining us. Our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, with me right now. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin's teaching a class right now, but he'll be in shortly, and we'll do it again with him. And Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be back on this lovely day, sunny day in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful day. And you know what? Let's start by talking about what you do. You direct the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies.
Yeah, that otherwise known as SIMS, because it's a lot of words to say.
Yeah.
So we follow NASA and add it into an acronym. But that's a collaboration between the University of Wisconsin in Madison and the satellite division of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And so we work collaboratively, very tightly, with some of the NOAA scientists in the satellite division in developing new tools to analyze existing satellites as well as the new ones that are being planned for launch. And so there was, just last year, the GOES-R satellite, which got launched and became the GOES-16. GOES is for the Geostationary Environmental Operating Satellite, Operational Satellite. So it's one of the ones every day when you see satellite imagery of weather storms moving across the U.S., it's coming from those GOES satellites.
And it's cooperative institutes, so as you say, there are the UW-Madison and others.
Yeah, so we work closely. We actually have six NOAA scientists, so government scientists stationed in the same place as us, working side by side on addressing some of the science problems and making sure we can apply the science to the need of NOAA in terms of improving weather forecasts. So it's a real good example of the Wisconsin idea in action, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. As you look at those problems, what are some of the major things that you're kind of noodling about right now?
So, noodling's a good word because it is kind of fun. The things that come to mind immediately that I can think of is, one, we have a group working on volcanic ash. And so when volcanoes go off, they spew ash, spit off gases and aerosols, particles into the atmosphere that the FAA wants to avoid. And so there are volcanoes. They do have some sensors on volcanoes, but a lot of volcanoes don't. And so the only way to tell is when they erupt, and you can pick that up first by satellite. So we have a group that's working on that. We have a group working on trying to determine where convection is going to start. I mean, that's the big challenge. We can generally forecast an area like southern Wisconsin. There'll be thunderstorms, but where will they develop is a challenge. And again, satellites play a pretty important role in identifying that pinpointing of where which storm is actually going to develop into a thunderstorm and which one will become a severe thunderstorm.
Yeah. Steve Ackerman, our guest, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and we're just talking about the institute he directs, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And by the way, if you have a question or comment, maybe there's something in the weather you're curious about, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Go ahead and email us at ideas@wpr.org or post your weather photo on our network Facebook page. We'll see. Yeah, we always love to see those photos as well. And John Martin will be joining us at noon today when he gets finished with his class, or maybe a couple minutes before that. So there was this last weekend, we had some February tornadoes that were pretty severe, not in Wisconsin, but elsewhere.
Yeah, and thankfully not in Wisconsin, although if it would have been in Wisconsin, it would have set a record, because this is the only month we have not have a tornado in Wisconsin, is the month of February. So that's good. We had a lot of rain, well, even just south of us, not even in Wisconsin. There was a lot of flooding just south of Lake Michigan, the Chicago area. Had a lot of precipitation, I think 5 or 6 inches down there. That's a heck of a lot when the ground is frozen and there's snow out to be melted. And so that led to a lot of urban type flooding.
I was thinking about that. Today is a warmer day in southern Wisconsin, at least, I think across the state. But, I mean, tomorrow it's going to get up over 50 degrees.
Yeah, it's going to get really warm.
Would there be any chance of a tornado under those circumstances?
Probably not. Usually we want it to be more moister in the lower layer of the atmosphere, which means generally warmer as well. And then it's where the location of the jet stream is pretty critical. And so right now it's this time of year, usually it's further south. And so that's why the tornadoes generally start further south. And then as we progress into June, the jet stream moves further north. And then that becomes the month where we get most of our tornadoes.
Which month was it?
June.
June is our big tornado month.
It's our big tornado month.
Yeah. Well, we have lots of callers online with questions. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. There was another interesting thing that I wanted to ask about, but maybe I'll wait on that. And because Dean in Eau Claire has a question for us, so let's go there. Dean, hi. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question for you, and at one time I thought I knew the answer to this, but I have forgotten. Anyway, my wife and I were out walking at about 6:15 a.m., and it was about 5 degrees, very calm, nice morning. And when we got home, it was down to about zero. And she said, you know, I thought it felt like it was getting colder as we were walking. And I said, well, I said, a lot of times just before the sun comes up, the temperature does tend to drop. And she said, why does that happen? And I said, well, I don't know, but I think I might know who might know that answer. So I'm posing you guys the question.
This is a really interesting phenomena. And so the temperature of an object, and air is one of those, will increase or decrease depending on the total energy gains and losses. And so what happens in that case, because I know we've had callers, hunters, for example, say the same thing. They're out hunting, and then the sun comes up, and the temperature continues to drop.
Correct.
And you think that you are getting more gains from the solar energy because you can feel it on your body begin to warm up. But even at that case, because the sun is so low in the sky, that the energy gains do not yet exceed the losses, and so the temperature continues to drop.
All right, so it's dropping along.
It's dropping. It starts to drop, but the rate at which it's decreasing begins to change. Until the sun gets high enough that the energy gains exceed the losses, and those losses are through infrared radiation. All objects emit. Infrared radiation.
There we go.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
And John just walked in. Does that make sense?
Speaking of gains, perfect sense. I'm talking about it in class.
Speaking of gains and losses,
that's right.
We just gained John. John, of course, a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. What are you teaching, by the way, John,
I'm teaching the introductory class in weather and climate, and we're right on this radiation stuff. We talked about the seasonal cycle today, but the daily temperature cycle is right next. It's really interesting. In fact, it's an easier argument to make than the seasonal one.
Oh, yeah, right.
So.
Well, I tell you what. You should have your class listen to the show.
Hey, why not? Yeah.
Ted and Toma has a question for you guys, so let's just go there. Ted, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I don't know if it's a question, an observation, or if it's just the way my head works, but I noticed the difference on the high and lows, the record high and lows for the days. There was about a week ago, it was 90 degrees different, 27 below to 63 above. Mm. And that, is that, is that what's the highest it's ever been, I guess, as far as the difference? And
great.
I think John actually knows the answer to that.
I don't, but I think it's a great question. Ted, I couldn't agree with you more. That's one of the most fascinating questions. My guess for Madison is going to be it's January 30th, because that's when we had our all-time minimum, minus 37. And I believe we've flirted with 60s in late January before. So I'm going to say it's close to 100 degrees Fahrenheit difference between the all-time high and the all-time minimum on the same calendar day.
That's what I was wondering, because it was just a couple weeks ago, and the interesting part is they were only a year apart, 1920 and 1921 or something.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That is really interesting.
Yeah, but so are these record lows going to kind of stick around now because of just the way the climate's heading, and we're going to be breaking more record highs, do you think?
We do break four times as many record highs as we do record lows. We had a period in late December, early January, where we broke a good number of record lows, actually, around the country, which was one of the first treasure hoards of record lows in quite a long time. But overall, that is going to be the case, I'm afraid, yes.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Paul in Galesville. Paul, hi.
Hey, Larry. It's Paul Kinzer. I was on your show last week.
Oh, hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Last night here in town, we saw lightning. Mm. And it's happened before at this time of year, but I've always wondered, it sounds, or it seems to sound different to me. Instead of a low rumbling booming, it sounds higher pitched almost. Hmm. And I'm wondering if that's true and how rare is lightning at this time of year and maybe a bit of the why.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul.
Boy, that's a good question. A
couple things that come to mind for me is, first of all, I think it is more rare in January and February.
Yeah, for sure.
Considerably. We're at the minimum. But then the thing that comes to mind for me, depending on where you are, is if you've got snow on the ground and it's nighttime.
I was going to say, too.
Yeah, there's a stability issue. So maybe maybe the sound waves get refracted by the low-level stable layer and they change their complexion a little bit.
And the snow. You know, it's going to act as a sound buffer.
It muffles it, yeah.
Muffles
might
as well.
Take some of the high or low frequencies out or something.
Yeah. We'll talk some more about that right after the news. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at climate and weather. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today is Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, as is Steve, by the way. Great to have them along, and thanks for joining us. Weather or climate question, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And just to follow up briefly on that last call, the sound difference, there is quite a difference in the atmosphere, isn't there? And
there's a difference in the way it's stratified, what it's covered with, and then what's falling through it, as we were talking about.
Yeah.
So all three of those things can probably do some processing of sound waves.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, let's go to Patricia in Madison next. Hi, Patricia. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. With all the activity that Elon Musk has been doing with his SpaceX and sending whatever up into the atmosphere, do any of those things interfere with the weather satellites?
No, I would say, particularly not the car that he set up there. There are a lot of international agreements and national agreements as well with regard to where in orbit you'll put your satellites, whether they're communication or weather or some other DOD or something like that. So, yeah, so they have not interfered. In fact, I think actually we're getting into trying to produce smaller satellites. We call them cube satellites because they're about the size of a loaf of bread. And so in some of their commercial flights, SpaceX will also spew out or launch these CubeSats as well. And a lot of them are education-type satellites that different universities are working on.
Space junk is kind of an issue. I was thinking back to the movie of a few years back where...
They hit the International Space Station, right? One blew up or
something like that. Yeah.
That's still a worry. I mean, there is a lot of... we've been launching stuff since the 1950s, and a lot of it is still up there. And actually, a lot of it is monitored by the Air Force, in our case, tracking stuff to make sure that they don't collide or try to avoid collisions.
No.
So that's where SpaceX or any commercial company or even government company, government could cause a problem if they have a failed launch and they lose contact so they can't manipulate it. And then it's just, you know, roaming around, just being pulled by natural forces.
Yeah.
And that's very dangerous.
Undoubtedly wreaking havoc.
Wreaking havoc, I mean, in fact, they're told there was a satellite. We had a train of them. So there were a bunch of them. They weren't tied together, but they were, you know, within a few miles of each other, within seconds of each other. And then as soon as it looks like you're losing control, or something's going wrong, then they're required to pull it out of that orbit, just because it's a very popular orbit to put research satellites and weather satellites in.
Very interesting. Thanks, Patricia. Appreciate
the
call. Let's go to Leo in Dodgeville next. Hi, Leo.
Howdy. My question is about lenticular clouds and how they relate to clear air turbulence. And I understand that there's waves that are produced by lenticular clouds over the mountains, and those, I guess, just go out. And I'm just wondering how far out they come away from, and assuming that they are formed by mountain waves, if you will, how far out into the, you know, out into the United States they might travel from the Rockies.
Boy, that's a great question. So I lived in Colorado, and you could see these, and you're right, these lenticular clouds can be formed over mountains. So as air rushes over the mountains, particularly if the air is perpendicular to the mountain range, as it comes up and over the mountain, it can go up and down just like a roller coaster. And sometimes at the peak, because as the air is going up, it will, the relative humidity will increase, and you can form cloud droplets that form these nice lens-shaped clouds called lenticular clouds. So at the top of that, you can get these clouds, and you can see a series of them, you know, on the ground. Looking up, you can see two or three of them that extend maybe 60 to 100 miles beyond the mountain range. But then if you go in the look at satellite imagery that look at water vapor, which also then measures upper troposphere relative humidity where those clouds are forming, you can see a string of lines that'll extend all the way to the end of Colorado.
Yeah.
And again, it's just that up and down motion, and it is tied to clear air turbulence. That's when planes go in there, we've correlated those features in satellites with pilot reports of turbulence, and they correlate very nicely.
I bet they do. That's really interesting.
Thanks, Leo. Appreciate the call. Bob in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, guys. It's 40 degrees as we speak in Eau Claire right now, under a mostly clear sky. I just read this morning an article in the Sydney Australia Observer, and it talks about scientists are seeing truly extreme events happening right now in the Arctic above the 80-degree parallel. And there's a weather station. The farthest north weather station is Camp Jessup, I believe is the name, and it's on the northern tip of Greenland. And they have recorded 2 days ago a temperature of -6 Celsius or centigrade, which is something on the order of 35 to 40 degrees below the average for that time of year in February, where it's still dark.
I think you mean above the average, right?
Above the average. So you're following me.
And
what they're saying is the polar vortex, which is this dome of cold that occupies that, has been predicted to start breaking down, and they're actually observing it breaking down, and this little single piece of data that they're talking about is, and I realize that's a data set of one, it's an observation that is completely out of the norm. So
yeah, that's true. We do have this stratospheric polar vortex that occurs every single winter when the northern hemisphere, especially high latitudes, cool and get in the dock. There's a really rapid westerly wind in the lower stratosphere about 10 millibars, maybe about 25 miles above the ground, that's very intense, and it does tend to corral to a certain degree the cold air that even reaches down into the troposphere. And every spring, there's a variable date on which that vortex disappears and doesn't come back until the next fall. This is early for that to happen. It's usually sometime in the late part of March, early April. So this is relatively early. It was preceded by an exceptional cold event over Hudson Bay over the last 10 days or so, beginning 7 or so days ago, where it was as cold as I've ever seen it at about a mile above sea level. And so I think the vortex this year has undergone some really interesting late season manipulations. And what's going on at Point Jessup is just one example of some really weird things that are going to be fun to investigate in the aftermath of this season.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, really wild.
The breakdown's really early, isn't it?
It's very early this year. But it may still come back. In fact, we had some evidence on Friday.
Has it gone away and come back?
It's come back this late before. But it's we saw some evidence on Friday that it seemed like it was trying to get its act together again. Because, as I say, it's about a month or 6 weeks away from its normal, on average, breakdown day.
Yeah.
But it's highly variable. So,
would something like this have to do with climate change? Or
it
not?
Might or it might not. There's enough of this variability in the naturally occurring atmosphere, okay. 50 or so years of observations of this, that we've had some break nearly this early. I don't know if late February would actually be one of the earliest. I honestly don't know that. I should, but
you
I don't.
You research
Yeah. Well, I'm getting into this a little bit, but I would guess that there's probably been one or two such examples.
Yeah. All right. Bob, thank you so much for calling. And Mark in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Thanks a lot. I'm wondering if anyone has done any studies linking forestry or forests with rainfall. I have lived in places in California where 30 miles apart, depending on the redwood trees, you'd have a difference in maybe 50 inches of rain, like from maybe 70 inches of rain to one place to 120 inches of rain, just depending on, I guess, how big the redwoods were.
Yeah, there's been a couple of studies that have looked at the role vegetation plays in precipitation, because one of the things vegetation does is pulls moisture out of the soil and transpires it and puts it up into the atmosphere. And we've, on a number of occasions, talked about how good corn is in doing that. And there's been some more studies as well about how the corn in Iowa has really, as an example, because they have so much corn, has really humidified the air. But two places I can think of are where I know there's been studies is deforestation. So looking at the Amazon, Brazil, what happens there when they cut down the rainforest and put it with the grasslands. And the other aspect is in Africa, so along the Sahel, where overgrazing kills the grasslands there and then dries out the area and leads to a desertification process by that. So, yeah, vegetation plays an important role in precipitation.
Yeah, and redwoods maybe have a really interesting story. Yeah, I wish I knew more about them, but most trees have as much root underground as they have tree above the ground, or at least quite a number of them do. And I wonder if the redwoods are like that, because they last thousands of years. They have to be able to put up with a lot of give and take with the weather.
Yeah,
and so you imagine they must dig really deep into the ground to make sure they have a water supply, and then they're miserly.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what they do to precipitation, because most of their water supply is from fog.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
That's where they
collect
get their
it on
water.
Drops. Yeah,
right, yeah.
So. And they're miserly too with it, aren't they? They have kind of a waxy, almost all the plants that have waxy
right.
sort of leaves.
Yeah.
They don't give up water very, very well.
Yeah.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And Connie in New Lisbon, your turn. Hi, Connie.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Well, my question is, there's been some recent publication of lower temperatures when the sun goes into its modern minimum. So I'm wondering, with studying weather and the climate, then if you also, by default, have to study the sun.
Yeah, you do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk a lot about weather satellites because we're looking at the weather that impacts us. But there's also what we call space weather, which is, you know, the aurora borealis and things that can knock out our electrical systems. And so many of these weather satellites also have instruments that look at the sun and monitor the sun and are continually taking imagery of the weather on the sun as well in order to try and predict what it's doing and how active it is and how that might impact the geophysical field around us, magnetic field.
Yeah, and and some of the satellites, too, are making really the most detailed measurements we've ever had of how much energy the sun outputs.
Yeah.
And that's been since 79 or even earlier, maybe?
79.
Yeah, okay. 79. So that's getting to be now a 40-year record, and that's pretty good. So we begin to get a handle on what the variability of the solar output is over lifetimes, anyway, human lifetimes.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Connie. Appreciate it. Marilyn in Mequon. Hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. I have a question about howling wind. Yesterday, my puppy and I were running at our tennis courts at the high school, and the tennis courts are on a hill above the surrounding trees, and I heard the wind really howling. At times, the howling seemed to be coming through the trees, and then it sounded like it was coming from above the trees in the sky.
Hmm.
What causes the wind to howl?
Well, that's a good question.
It must just be kind of the same thing that makes a woodwind instrument work. You blow wind through a chamber of some kind, and you get a sound. And with an instrument, of course, you can manufacture it. With a line of trees or even through a fence at a tennis court, you're going to get, with a strong wind like we had yesterday, you're going to get, a lot of compression of the air going through either trees or a fence, and it makes sounds.
Yeah.
It generates sound waves. It's really interesting, but that's all I could say about
it. Yeah, right. That's what I would think, too. The other sound you hear is, the objects as they're moving, but that's not really howling.
But the howl through pine trees or something is just awesome. It's one of the greatest things on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
I love it.
Thanks, Marilyn.
And it wasn't wolves, right?
Yeah, right. Up there, you got to differentiate.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call, and we'll get you on here. I haven't been giving that number enough. We haven't talked about this for a long time, but you guys have a weather blog. It's called The Weather Guys. And it has a pretty cool logo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
tell us about it and where listeners can find it.
So the site that I think the best site to go in my mind is SSEC.Sims. So SSEC dot, or search on Sims, and that'll take you to the webpage.
How do you spell it?
CIMSS, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And on that main page, if you look to the side, there'll be a link to the Weather Guys. And that's our blog. That's usually what we do for the newspaper down here in Wisconsin, which you've been doing since 2008.
It's a long time now, 10 years.
Yeah. So we'll answer questions. People will post questions there if they can't wait until the last month. Monday of the month.
Yeah.
They can email a question on that site.
That would be great.
Yeah. And then we have a great logo where John is the summer guy and I'm the winter guy.
It's a long disputed, but it works.
Right.
He actually does look better as the snow miser than I would, but I love the winter.
Well, on a recent entry, you talked about how weather can affect beer making.
Weather, in my mind, affects...
What did you find out about that?
Weather affects everything. That's what I often say. And you know this when you're cooking, or if you change from one site to another in terms of humidity, for example.
Yeah.
Beer in particular, you want to keep it in a nice, cool place. So that's why people put it in their basement, because that's more of a controlled environment and kind of insulates you from the outside weather activities, for sure.
And I remember Steve said he'd heard about this. He didn't really know about it.
Right.
He didn't know about it personally.
Right. I just thought it might have an effect on the hops that's grown.
And the hops as well. That's right. Where the hops are brewed, there was a big... I forget the year now. That's probably on the blog, where a lot of hops are grown in the northwest region of the U.S. And I think it was they had a real wet year, and so they lost a lot
said,
of their hops. And now there's a group in Wisconsin that's trying to bring back hop growing in Wisconsin.
Forest Valley Hops has been a leader in that.
Mm-hmm. In doing that.
Here in Wisconsin, and we're getting some pretty good hops.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's leading, I think, to quite a revolution in the craft beer industry in this state.
Yeah, because you can get it locally, which is always nice.
Yeah, you can get it locally. So there's more than 100 craft beer establishments Not that I visited them all. But
you've heard.
Oh, geez, I only thought there was 79.
Yeah, right.
I visited a few of them. Well, let's talk about the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. That's something else we haven't done for a while. John, talk about the department a little bit.
Our department is the most energetic group of scholars that I think anybody could ever hope to be affiliated with. We have people studying all manner of problems about the atmosphere and ocean in our department. We're currently undergoing a search that we're going to hire at least two new people. We're really very excited about that. First time in about 7 or 8 years. So we're emerging from a period where we struggled to maintain a young group in our department, and it's coming back now. And, you know, we look at problems that span, as I said, from how clouds are formed on the microscale all the way up to how the climate system is interacting with, individual weather systems and large-scale ocean phenomena. So it's, as I say, there's no place that I'd rather work than that place. And my colleagues are spectacular people to work with.
They're
just
the
spectacular.
Top people in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, we get recruited all the time. Everybody on the faculty's had an outside offer in the last 5 years. Everybody. And more than one. So people around the world, not just around the country, are looking at our department and saying, hey, we'd like to try and pick some of these people off because they're so good. So that's how it is.
Well, you have a number of people, a number of students, and they can't all be television weather people.
No. Nope.
Although I'm sure I know many of them have turned into that profession.
Yeah, that's
but what
true.
What other jobs are out there for somebody that's interested in this?
There's been an explosion in the private sector. Of jobs, private forecasting companies, so they might have some similarity to a weather service job. The weather service has become a little bit more difficult to enter now than because it's been cut back and there's fear of more cutbacks. But then there are all kinds of different jobs that even 10 or 12 years ago we weren't thinking were going to be on the horizon, working for reinsurance companies, insurance and reinsurance companies, assessing weather-related risk for commodities trading or for futures of various other types of things. So there's a lot of new places for people to go. And the training they get is dealing with large data sets and how to handle them in a computational way. I mean, these are skills that just about every big business needs. So we've got people going all over the place with the skills that they get in our department.
Yeah, it's really cool. Lots of opportunity there. Dick in West Salem has a question for you. Dick, hi. What's on your mind?
Hey, this is a question that I feel dumb asking, but what is wind? I can feel the wind, and I know the wind is out there, but what actually is it?
Hmm. So you can feel the wind, you can hear the wind, you can see what it does to things like trees and so forth?
Yep.
So wind is air in motion, and so the things you feel are the molecules, mostly nitrogen and oxygen, as they're moving and they hit your face, your skin, or whatever, you detect that impact. Since they're moving, there needs to be a force, and the primary force is a difference in pressure. So difference in pressure from one area to another will generate a horizontal force that makes the wind move, and the bigger that pressure difference, the stronger the wind.
Yeah, and one of the things that is easy to overlook is the fact that the wind actually has mass. You can weigh it. You can put it in a bag and weigh it. And so when it moves, when the air moves, naturally you're going to feel it because it actually is something massive going by you at a certain speed. You can flap your arms around in the air and act as if there's nothing there, but there's something there.
And that's why things get blown over.
That's right. Right.
So how do you weigh it?
You don't want to do it the way Aristotle did. He put it in a leather bag and found that an empty leather bag and a full one weighed the same. That's what he did, actually.
Did he really?
Yeah, not a very good experiment. But you can do it. You can do it in more sophisticated instruments, probably in such a simple way, even today.
Yeah.
You probably.
I mean, one way is the pressure, the weight of the air.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, of course.
That's the most direct way to do it.
Well, here we are at the end of another last Monday of the month show here. Guys, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit, March 26th.
Mm. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. The winds of March or whatever, the Ides of March.
The Ides of March.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman. I always want to say John Ackerman.
Nobody else wants you to ever say that.
They'll be back on March 26th. Tomorrow, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk joins us for a look at your pet's health. Stay with us. Lots in store.